What shall we say then to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? He that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? It is God that justifieth. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather, that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword? As it is written, for thy sake we are killed all the day long. We are accounted as sheep for the slaughter. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord.
Well, good morning. It's good to be with you guys on this Sunday morning. I wish it was under different circumstances, but it has been good to see Pastor. We call him Dad, or I call him Chief from time to time. And so Friday night, He was able to come home, and so Angela and Lily and London, they made a little welcome home sign, and there were some balloons, and so it was good to have him home. And so he's home today, still not quite feeling up to being here, and my sweet little Lily, our little 3.5-year-old, she's not feeling well, and so my wife is home with her and with our other daughter. So all kinds of sickness going through our house, but two made it. Mom Holdridge and I, we emerged from the house of sickness to be here today. But if you continue to pray for him, for Dad, it's amazing though, because he's in great spirits, and had a great conversation with him last night, and it's very refreshing to be around someone who's facing uncertainty, but yet is unwavering in his trust of God's plan, and just looking around him and seeing his family all around him, and just trusting. So that's been a great encouragement and example to me. But have you ever found yourself in a season of life where maybe God pushed you a little bit, or you felt like you were being tested? And you went through this season, and even as you went through it, maybe people were questioning the decisions you were making, or people were asking you, like, why is God allowing this to happen to you? Maybe it was suffering, or maybe it was loss of a job, or something, just some heartbreak that came into your life. But as you look at it, you realize that season, you truly learned some powerful things about God. You truly learned some ways to trust him in fresh ways, and your faith was really deepened during that season, so that when you've been faced with similar circumstances as your life has sort of unfolded, you find yourself able to look back at those moments. And because you've gone through those experiences, because God has shown you that even during a time of testing or trials or hardship, that he's there with you. And you can look back at those moments, of those memories, and that's part of spiritual maturity, is being able to look back and see, well, how did God lead me in the past, or how did God teach me in the past, which enables you then to move forward in the present. Have you experienced a season like that, or a moment like that? This morning we're going to look at a story that probably everyone in here, even people who do not attend church, even people who don't know that much about God, are familiar with in our culture. The story is about a shepherd boy who squares off against a 9-foot, 9-inch giant by the name of Goliath. David and Goliath is a story that's summoned anytime you watch the NCAA basketball tournament, and it's a small school against a big powerhouse. Invariably, they use that David and Goliath picture. It's the idea of the underdog. It's the idea of the guy who has no shot in the world to defeat this overwhelming favorite. But I want to look at it today in a little different light. And so I just want to set a little bit of context. Our text for the morning, we will get to Romans 8 for sure, but I didn't want to ask Rich to read 55 verses in 1 Samuel chapter 17. So I picked a corollary passage. I hope you appreciate that. But if you want to turn to 1 Samuel 17, where we are at this point of the development of the life of David, in 1 Samuel 16, if you remember, God was very displeased with Saul. And Saul was chosen from among the people because the people of Israel were tired of being different than all the other nations. They were what was called a theocracy. So they were being ruled by God, and they had judges and prophets that would sort of tell them what to do. And they wanted a king. And so God gave them a king from among them. They chose Saul, who was a Benjamite. And he chose him. Saul, it says in the text that Saul was handsome, and he was head and shoulders above everyone else. He was much taller, so probably a foot taller than the average man. So you could kind of accurately guess that Saul was somewhere between 6 feet 6 inches and 6 feet 9 inches based on the average height of an Israelite man, or even the average height of a man today, which is 5'9"-ish. So Saul was chosen to be the king. And at first, everything was great. He had a lot of military victories, and things were going really well. But then Saul caved to peer pressure. If you remember when they were fighting the Amalekites, and God told him to destroy everything that he had, and Saul caved to the pressure of his advisors and people around him, said, listen, this livestock shouldn't be destroyed. If you remember, in that culture, livestock and all that farming, the animals and those things, that was like wealth. That was money. That was how you could tell someone was wealthy. So it would be the equivalent of taking over a nation, stacking up all their cash and lighting it on fire. What good can come of that? The people were saying, why would you just destroy all this wealth where we can even sacrifice it to God? But Saul knew what God had said, and he chose to disobey. And from that moment on, God's favor left Saul, and God told Samuel to go to the house of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, from that little town of Bethlehem, which at the time of Jesus' birth was somewhere between 150 and 300 people. We don't know how big it was when David grew up there. But so Samuel goes to the house of Jesse, and Jesse had 8 sons, and he lines up the first 7 of them. Now, if that sounds unfair to you that he would leave out the 8th son, you have to understand in that culture that the more kids you had, the more it just sort of, they just took care of another chore that you had. Because really the first 2 or 3 were the only ones that really mattered as far as inheritance went and as far as standing and all that stuff. So they lined up the first 7 sons. You had Eliab, and he was the eldest, and he stood there tall and strapping, and Samuel walked up to him and was like, well, surely this is the Lord's anointed. Look at this one. He's so impressive. And God said, do not look at the outside. For man looks at the outside. I look at the heart. Maybe a little stinging jab at Samuel for the people's desire to have Saul, who was so impressive on the outside, yet his heart was quick to desert and disobey God. And so Samuel walks down the line, each one impressive and each one a possible king. And each one, God says, no, no, no. And Samuel gets to the end through all 7 and says, well, this is it. Jesse, do you have any more? And Jesse says, well, yeah, but he's my youngest. He's out in the fields. Well, send for him. So in comes David, a boy, probably over the age of 10, probably under the age of 13 at this point. He comes in from the fields. And God says, here he is. And so Samuel anoints him with a special anointing oil that was used in the coronation of a king. And it was very pungent. The odor of this oil would have been so strong because it was such a combination of spices that this odor would have remained in the house for many, many days after. And so David anointed in the presence of his brothers who were just passed over. So not only were his brothers stung by being passed over, now the runt of the litter that they've been picking on and kicking and mistreating all of his life. Now, and if you want another picture of that, remember how Joseph was treated by his brothers? The same idea, the young. And now, not only were they passed over, but now for several days after, if not longer, the scent of the anointing of the future king would just hang in the air, reminding them of God's rejection of them and God's anointing of their little brother. So the story in 1 Samuel 17 has the 3 eldest sons all fighting with Saul against the Philistines. Now the Philistines, there's about 13 different scuffles between Israel and the Philistines in Scripture, and this is one of them. And we have an earlier account that talks about how many Philistines would have been gathered at this place in the army, and we have evidence of tens of thousands would have been gathered on the Philistine side, and the Israelite army would have probably been smaller, but still multiple thousands. And so you've got this setting here in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Let's just dive into the text here. 17 verse 1 says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." If we were going to translate that, about 9 feet 9 inches or so. I'm 6'3", just to give you some perspective. So another 3 feet, almost to the ceiling, not quite. Very tall. "He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. And Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, 'Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said, 'I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." Now, if this seems odd to you, this one-on-one battle, this one-on-one matchup that they're using, this was actually pretty common in the ancient world. It was called representative warfare. And basically, two nations would gather, and rather than risk the loss of hundreds, thousands, or hundreds of thousands of lives and all the bloodshed and cost, each side would select a champion to fight, and whoever won was then the superior nation, and the other one was subservient. They were into slavery. They were going to be oppressed now by the victorious nation. So this was the warfare that the Philistines wanted to fight in this moment. This is the way they went. And Saul and the Israelite armies that were gathered, it said in verse 11, "When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." They were shaking. And what's interesting is that this, again, Saul was king because Israel wanted to be like other nations. And this was warfare that was employed by other nations. But it's interesting because God doesn't like this type of warfare. In fact, God gave very clear rules and regulations regarding how the Israelites are to fight. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. But it's interesting here, you have Saul, the king, the leader, and all of his soldiers are greatly afraid. Isn't it interesting how the response of the leader, of the king, impacts his followers and his soldiers? He's afraid, therefore, they're all afraid. So that's the setting right there. Now, let's enter David into the story. Verse 12. "Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to David his son, 'Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them.' Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers." I'm just going to pause there. So here's David. David's injected into the story. He's not old enough to go fight, but his father says, hey, take this care package to your brothers who are fighting. And oh, by the way, take some cheeses. Now, it took me a while. He said, bring these 10 cheeses. It took me a while to name 10 types of cheese. I don't know if you guys are pretty good at your cheese naming, but I got 10, but it took me a little while. I think Brie was the one that put me at number 10. It took me a while. I don't really know what that tastes like, but, you know, I got my cheddars and the Swisses and all that stuff, but he was supposed to bring 10 cheeses and all of this bread to his brothers and then kind of give it to the commander to make sure that his brothers were in very good stead. Now, Rich, you just served over, and I'm sure if one of a care package came specifically marked for you with some fine cheeses, would that give you a little better perspective on those soldiers that were responsible for such things? No comment, huh? So he's basically bringing this care package, just a present from his dad to his brothers. And then he was supposed to bring back some kind of a token or some kind of evidence that they were still alive and that they were okay. Well, obviously nobody knew what was going on in the battlefield here. No one was tweeting what was happening here. No status updates like day 40, same stuff is going on. Nobody knew. So as far as his dad knew, these brothers could be dead, they could be intense fighting, maybe they needed some bread and cheese to lift their depleted energy. He didn't realize that all they've been doing is running and hiding and eating bread and cheese, probably. And so he goes. He goes to it, but I love how he shows up. When Jesse tells him what he's going to do, it says that he gets up early in the morning. Don't you love that? Remember when Abraham was told by God to go and sacrifice Isaac? It says he got up early in the morning to go. I love that. When God gives a command to someone, or even David hears the command of his father to go do something, gets up early. It shows just an excitement and a dedication and a strong obedience. He gets up early. He gets to the battle line. And he gives all of these gifts. I almost see David getting into kind of like a trance, like, I mean, just all of the sounds of, you know, horses and chariots and soldiers and just chanting and people talking and yelling, all the movement, and he gets there and he's got all this cheese and bread, and he kind of just gives it to the guy who's handling all the baggage, and then runs, it says, he runs to the battle lines to find his brothers. Now, if you're not wearing any armor, and you're just there to drop off some bread and cheese, would you be really inclined to race up to where the battle line is drawn? Wouldn't you kind of want a special, like, hazmat armored suit or something, or like a big flag that says visitor or something, you know? Don't spear me. I'm just observing today. I'm not in this. But no, he runs up and he finds his brothers and he's talking to them about what's going on. But you know what I love? I think there's a little significant nugget in this about the difference between David and Saul. And I mean, that's not a stretch to say that. There's a huge difference, and the scriptures point that out repeatedly. But do you remember, think about when Saul was about ready to be inaugurated and coronated as king. If you remember this, they chose him. He was kind of, you know, very hesitant. And then it says that all of a sudden they couldn't find him. Do you remember where he was hiding? He was hiding in the baggage. Saul, when he was ready to become king, hid in the baggage, 6 feet 9 inches tall, cowering inside a little Samsonite bag or something, I don't know. He's hiding! And it says they had to go find him, and then they ran to get him, and they dragged him back and said, here's our king. Full of courage, apparently. And then here's David, who shows up at the battle, he chucks the cheese and the bread at the guy with the baggage, and he races to the battle. Isn't that cool that you see that little, the baggage is used both times. David, the little boy, teenager, runs to the battle line, ditching his stuff with the baggage handler. Saul hides with the baggage handler when he's supposed to become king. Just an interesting side note. So David gets to the battle line. Everyone's drawn together. This is day 41. Verse 23 says, as he talked with them, his brothers, that is, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. But notice the next little clause there, the little sentence that says, and David heard him. I love that they included that. He spoke the same words as before. In other words, they went out morning and evening. Goliath repeated the same taunt 80 times. And 80 times they ran away in fear. 80 times they trembled. 80 times they were deflated and defeated and scared. Everyone from Saul to Abner to Jonathan, Eliab, all of these fierce warriors have been humiliated 80 times. And yet this time, David heard it. This little phrase, this moment is going to change history. Because David heard it. And he couldn't believe what he just heard. David heard it. Look at verse 24. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." So you hear the desperation of Saul at this point? You know he probably didn't start with that offer on day one. Day one was kind of like, all right, guys, who's our champion? Who's going to fight for God and for Israel? Crickets are chirping. And then, okay, we're going to make you very, very wealthy. Whoever wants to fight, you're going to be rich. Nobody. Okay, not only are you going to be rich, but you will never have to pay taxes, ever. That's what that means. His house will be free in Israel. No taxes for that, not only for whoever fights, but for his entire family moving forward. And then lastly, he says, you can marry my daughter. So he's offering him a position in the royal family. You could be a prince. Royalty, wealth, tax-free. Nobody is budging. Because think about the pressure of this moment. If you raise your hand and say, sure, I'll do it. That sounds great. If you lose, everyone, all of your soldier friends that you went through training with, all the guys you grew up with, your family, your friends, everyone you know in Israel is going to be under the rule of the Philistines. Everything will be lost. Many people will probably die and go into slavery. And you're sitting here thinking, okay, is it worth it? Risk versus reward. Do I want to be the guy that's remembered throughout the history of Israel as being the one who very brashly stepped forward and risked everything and lost quickly? But David heard him. Look at verse 26. And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." You see the scene here? He heard what they said. He's not asking them to repeat it because he doesn't understand it. He's doing the, wait, hold on. What's going to be done? Guys, you hear this? What? He's going to be rich? He's going to be a prince? No more taxes? Guys, this is a huge offer. Who's going to do this? Who is this guy? He's just an uncircumcised Philistine. He's a pagan. God's going to wipe him out. Who's willing to stand? Verse 28, Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when David spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." Or the Hebrew there actually means, come down to be seen at the battle. In other words, he's showing up for the photo op, but not really fighting. He just wants people to know he was at the battle. See how he's belittling him here? And isn't it interesting? He says, "And I know the evil of your heart." When God chose David because of David's heart. In fact, how is David remembered thereafter? A man after God's own heart. Yet here's Eliab, who is passed over, who has heard Goliath's challenge 80 times and shrank down in cowardice every time. Now he has the audacity to say that David's heart is evil and that he's there for the wrong reasons. Do you think there's some bitterness there between these brothers? Some anger, some resentment, some jealousy? And David said, verse 29, "What have I done now? Was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. So David's walking around just trying to get the morale up. Can you imagine how deflated and defeated these soldiers are at this point? To every day be humiliated like this. Verse 31, when the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. So the morale was so low that the encouragement of a little boy that was a shepherd boy made it to the ears of the king pretty quickly. Like, wait, there's someone talking positively in the camp? Bring him to me right now. Let's see who this guy is. And David says to him, I'll fight. I'll do it. Don't let anyone else's heart fail. I will do it. And what does Saul say? You're not able to go against this Philistine, verse 33, to fight with him, for you're but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth. You think about that. David's action in this moment, his statement, as he's walking around the camp and the things he's saying, his brother's angry, his brother is confused. Why are you doing this, David? What are you doing? Just go home. You're caught, you're stirring things up. What does Saul do? He's a lost for words. What are you talking about? You're just a boy. Goliath's going to eat you for breakfast. The word for a confusion like that, or for something that disorients people, an action that throws people for a loop, is the word bewilder. David's actions were bewildering to his brothers and to the king. Who is this guy? Verse 34. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. You see what he says? Right here, the first thing I want to say is David knew the past. When Saul challenges him, says, who are you? You're just a little kid. You're just a teenager. He was between probably 14 and 17 years old during this account, based on when he came to power as a king later. So Saul's looking at him like, what are you talking about? You're just a boy. You're not even old enough to fight in my army. Why should we allow you? Why should you go and stand against Goliath? Just get out of here. You have no idea what you're talking about. And David says, you know what? Actually, I do, because I've been a shepherd and I've been watching my brother's flocks. His father's flocks, but they're going to become his brother's flocks. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I guess, when we talked about the shepherds around Christmas time, if you remember that. But David was watching an inheritance that wasn't his. He really had no vested interest in keeping those sheep alive, especially when a lion or a bear came after them. Now, I just want, hopefully, if you're like me, well, hopefully you're not like me, because when I hear that, I'm like, okay, the thought of being out in the, and I've been in Israel in these areas where David was, and you see the areas where the shepherds were, and you're kind of in the mountains, and lions really like to hunt at night, mostly. They've got incredible night vision. And you know, the legends are that their eyes glow at night. It's not true, they reflect the moonlight, but it looks like it's glowing. So as if it wasn't scary enough to know that a lion is out there hunting, when it gets close enough to see you, his eyes are glowing. That's just fantastic. And a lion's roar, which is done to signify to other lions where he is and also to scare prey, can be heard up to 5 miles away. So you're out there, you're a boy, and you're by yourself, and you've got your sling and your staff and your harp, or whatever else David composed his poetry and his songs on, and all of a sudden you hear the roar of the lion, and the lion comes and takes a sheep. Do you just roll over? Okay, he only took one. That sounds good. Bernie's not that hungry tonight. Or Larry the lion or whatever. No. He chases after this lion. And now he describes it here as saying if he gets the lamb out of its mouth, maybe he's great with the slingshot, as we'll know later. Maybe he slings it with a rock and hits it in the back and the lion drops the sheep and runs. It says, but if he turns to me, and if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard. Now, I don't know what kind of beard we're talking about here, if these were the ZZ Top lions where you could be like this far away and pulling on a beard, or if it's like a normal beard, you know, the lion mane that goes down around like that. I've been teaching this story to Lily, and she has a little lion, very conveniently. The bears she has are very teddy bear-like, so it's not the same force, but the lion has this little, you know, the mane, and so I'm like, he grabbed him by his beard. So she wants to hear about the lion, the bearded lion every night to talk about it. But he grabs it by the beard. I mean, that's by its mouth. And he wrestles the thing, and he kills it. He stabs it or beats it with a staff. And in that moment, he's not saying that I am strong or I am like Samson or that I am like Goliath as a young lad. He says very clearly that God enabled me to do it. God allowed me to kill the lion and the bear. And this Goliath will be just like one of them. Because he's coming against God's people. He knew the past. He looked back at what God had done before. He realized no one else was acting. And he said, well, in the past, God has given me the strength or the ability to use my gifts and talents and abilities to defeat evil, to defeat those that were going after this thing I'm responsible for. Isn't it great too to see David's heart as a shepherd reflect the heart of God and the heart of Jesus as the good shepherd? What does Jesus say? The good shepherd goes after the one and leaves the 99. So when one is grabbed by a lion or a bear, the good shepherd goes after it and fights for it and brings it back. This is a man after God's own heart. That is the heart of God for us. He goes after the one. He doesn't let you go and say, well, at least I still have 99% of my flock here. So David knows the past and he cites it. In Deuteronomy 20, this is something else I think that David would have known and Saul should have known, and he is not putting into action. Remember I talked about the kind of the laws about warfare? Listen to Deuteronomy 20, verse 1. It says, when you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priests shall come forward and speak to the people and say to them, hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. It's funny because all these words were just used to describe exactly what's happening to them every day, twice a day. For the Lord, verse 4 says, for the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you the victory. And David is just saying, hey, this is what God has told us to do. God, it doesn't matter how big the army is. It doesn't matter how big the giant is. It doesn't matter how big the obstacle is. It doesn't matter how intimidated we are or how little we feel. God is the one who's going to fight. Remember in Ephesians 6 where it talks about the battle's not against flesh and blood, but against the unseen forces. And it says that to put on all of our spiritual armor, the helmet, the breastplate, all of these different pieces. And then at the end it says, so that when the day of evil comes, you will stand. It doesn't say that you will fight. It just says that you can stand and God will fight for you. And David just comes to Saul and says, listen, if no one else is going to claim these promises, then God in my life has shown me that a little boy can overcome the king of the jungle, and a little boy can overcome a Syrian brown bear, which would have been around in that time. If a little boy can do that, then a teenager can stand up against a giant because God is the one who does it anyway. Look what Saul says. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. You wonder if he just mumbled under his breath because he's not with me anymore. Verse 38, then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off, and he grabbed his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, I used to read that and think, wow, that was nice of Saul. He's giving him the best armor. He's trying to get him all ready to go. But what's interesting is, in that day and age, they believed, the other nations believed, that if someone was to do something great wearing someone else's clothing or using their sword, that somehow the essence and the power and the spirit of the owner willed them to victory. So in other words, Saul wasn't willing to go fight, but he was hoping that his armor would win so then he could say, well, obviously I wasn't feeling well. I had that, you know, the bursitis and this thing and that thing. But I gave David my sword and the little boy won because I was with him in spirit. It'd be like now, you know, your favorite player giving you a jersey and you put it on and you're like, I don't know what happened, but I was just in the zone because I was wearing that jersey. So even in that moment, Saul was trying to grasp at straws to take some sort of kingly credit for this victory. But David, it didn't fit. It didn't fit. So David grabs his shepherd's staff, goes to the water, grabs 5 smooth stones. Now notice this. It says smooth stones, not small stones. So in my flannel graph memory, they were always small. I think there's even songs about small stones, right? Now I'm not trying to completely destroy your childhood memories here, but the position of a slingshot artist was a military position. And you know what tribe was so famous for this? The Benjamites. What tribe was Saul from? Man, it's just so rich, isn't it? So it said that there were 700 Benjamites that were skilled in the arts of the slingshot. And it said that they were so accurate that they could hit a hair out of someone's hand. Now, I would not want to be the guy holding that hair. I'm just going to tell you that right now. The guy who held that was the one who did not bring the bread or cheese. Right, Rich? So what they would use a smooth stone, but they would try and find a stone that was about 1 pound. And that would be kind of a distance thing. And they were left-handed. They would sling these things kind of from a distance. Now, just to give you an idea, they could get these 1 pound smooth stones going up to 100 miles an hour. Now, those of you that are sports fans like myself, I immediately think of standing in a batter's box facing a baseball at 100 miles an hour. A baseball weighs 5 ounces. This rock that he would have been looking for would have been 3 times that heavy. If a guy gets hit in the head wearing a batting helmet with a 100 mile an hour fastball, he doesn't remember where he lives or anything about his life, and maybe he's never the same. If you get hit in the forehead with a 1 pound stone at 100 miles an hour by someone who's so accurate he can knock the hair out of someone's hand, you're going to drop to your knees and die. And that's just what happened. So David and Goliath stand across from each other. Verse 41, and the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him or despised him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Just to let you know, ruddy means he had red hair, red complexion. So, another flannel graph change for some of you. Ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And now, listen to what he does here. Remember, this is representative warfare. Very strict rules. The only one who dies is the loser. Everyone else just kind of goes home peacefully in handcuffs. Look what he says. He says, I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all of this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. You think that finally these soldiers that have been cowering behind the battle lines, ready to sprint back to their tent for the 81st time, are starting to get a little bit excited? Or do you think they're kind of like, I can't look, but I have to peek? You know, they're knowing that it's all going to end soon. But he says here, he looks beyond Goliath now, and he says, not only are you going to die, but all of you guys behind him that have been laughing your heads off and mocking Israel for the last month and a half, you are all going to die as well, because we're coming after you. I don't care what the rules of engagement are. We're coming after you because this is God's battle. He knew the past. He knew what God had done before. And now in this moment, he is willing to risk in the present. Think about the risk that he's taking for all of the nation of Israel. He's standing up against a guy that was twice his size. He's willing to do what no one else is willing to do. People think he's crazy. Wouldn't it be safer for him to stay back? Wouldn't it be wiser for him to use Saul's armor? But no, David would not be controlled. He would not be tamed. He would not obey what man is trying to stop him from doing. Instead, he chose that he was going to be wilder. And he was going to do what God told him to do, no matter if it made sense or not. If you think about this, he was risking in the present because he believed the future. He believed what God had promised him. God had just anointed him to be the future king of Israel. I'm not going to die here today. Remember when Abraham took Isaac up on the mountain and he took back his knife to kill his son? And the angels would say, Abraham, Abraham, stop, 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 don't do it. It says in Hebrews that Abraham had reasoned in his mind that God was going to raise Isaac from the dead, because how else would he be the child of promise that everything was going to go through? So Abraham was willing to risk killing his son because he believed the future that God had promised him. It wasn't going to change. The circumstances might be different, but he was going to obey God no matter what. So David knew the past, which allowed him to risk in the present because he believed the future. He believed that he was going to be king, and he believed in a bigger sense, in a more selfless way, that God was going to win the battle. That the battle was God's all along and not his. And so he believed the future God had for him and for the nation of Israel. Now think about what Saul was doing in this moment. Saul was living in the past. He was thinking about his past victories. He was sitting in his tent, hanging on to his throne that was going to be gone from him in a moment. And because he was living in the past, it paralyzed him in the present. He and no one else, including him, could move in that moment. They were paralyzed because they were afraid. They feared the future. They could not imagine how this was going to turn out. And so when you're afraid of the future, it paralyzes you in the present because you just want things to stay the way they've always been. That's where Saul is sitting in his tent, watching this all go. Why do I have to lose this? Let's just keep delaying. Let's see, maybe the Philistines will run out of food. Maybe they'll just get tired of this charade and they'll go home and we could just pretend this never happened and I can go back to my palace. Verse 48, when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. So David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, he just sensed them going, uh-oh. Didn't he just say we're all going to die now? When they saw this, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout. For the first time in 6 weeks, these guys were excited. They weren't cowering in fear. It says they rose with a shout. They all stood up and cheered, and they pursued, and they chased. And the men of Israel rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shoreim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. Now, why would David take the head of Goliath and ride into Jerusalem with it? I think there were years I just read that, I'm like, show off? Was he just like letting all the people know? Do you realize that at this point, Jerusalem was under the control of the Jebusites? That Saul and his king, they weren't even in Jerusalem at this point. So when David gets on his horse and takes the head of a world famous champion and rides into Jerusalem and holds it up, can you imagine? The Jebusites are like, what is this? David's serving notice. We'll be back very soon. And he gets on his horse and he rides back. And what's amazing is about 13 years later, David comes back into Jerusalem and overthrows the Jebusites and restores the kingdom and restores Jerusalem. David knew the past, which enabled him to risk in the present because he believed the future. So I don't know where this message finds you today. I don't know what trials God has brought you through, what moments you're up against, maybe what suffering and pain you're dealing with, or maybe a big decision that you have to make, a moment that you're not sure if you should stay or if you should go or if you should take the job or not, or if you should marry her or him or whatever the case may be. But in these moments, if we think about, if we look back at what God has done before in our lives, it's a blueprint of sorts that we can follow. So when we're in a moment where we're not really sure what to do, and the classic thing is to get on your knees and say, God, just show me what your will is. Just tell me what your will is. And we want to do the Gideon thing, right? We want to take the fleece and lay it outside and be like, just make it wet. Or with me, when I was a kid, I had a Nerf hoop in my house. And that was sort of the way I determined what God's will was, would be if I could make a shot when I asked him. And then if I made it and I didn't want the answer, I would try again and miss. That was when I was a teenager. David was killing a giant and I was playing Nerf Gideon hoops or something. But we find ourselves paralyzed in a sense, being like, God, how do I act? I'm not sure what to do. What's your will? What's your will? What's your will? And God is saying to you, look at your life. Look at how I've led you so far. Look at the talents and the giftings and abilities. Look at what you learned during that season of suffering and pain. Think about my word and think about my character and think about my goodness and what you've learned through that. Now, in the present, do the right thing. Do what God wants you to do. Step into the moment. Be willing to follow Him wherever He leads you. Because you believe the future. You believe that God has promises for you. You believe that He's never going to turn His back on you. He believes He's never going to give you more than you can handle. And in Romans 8 is the ultimate promise. When you're in that moment and you're like, God, I know what you've done in the past and I'm risking for you in the present. But will you just remind me what's happening in the future? What do I have to look forward to? How much are you going to let me handle? Don't you love this? What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? God is for us. It doesn't matter how tall the problem is. It doesn't matter how daunting the moment is. It doesn't matter how good the situation was that you were in. God is for you. Who can be against you? If you follow, whoa, I almost fell down these steps. That would have been quite the cap to the message right there, wouldn't it? No matter how badly you sprain your ankle in the middle of a message, God is for you. He who did not spare His own Son, but gave Him up for us all, how will He also not with Him graciously give us all things? Verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Now think of any moment you might be up against. Shall tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, or sword? I mean, can you think of a moment that doesn't quite get covered by those things? saying nothing can separate you from the love of God. Absolutely nothing. No matter how dark things seem to be, how hopeless they are, no matter how many days you've been hiding behind the battle line with all of your friends and family, paralyzed by the present and afraid to act, he's saying, in that moment, risk for me, act for me, because I love you, and nothing that happens, no matter what happens when you face that thing for me, no matter what happens, my love for you is eternal, and it never fails, and it never fades. And what is the worst that can happen to us in Jesus? What is the worst they can possibly do to us? They could take our lives and get us home to be with Jesus, which Paul says is better by far. He even said to the Philippians, "For I desire to depart and be with Jesus, which is better by far, but for your sake, Philippians, I remain. I'd rather be with him. Knowing all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm sure that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." When you choose to live in a way that people can't explain, when you make a decision that for God, to follow him, and maybe it's friends, maybe it's family, maybe it's people that you trust around you, and they're looking at you and going, "What are you doing? What you're doing right now makes no sense at all." And you say to them, "But it's what God's leading us to do, and I need to follow him." When you choose to do that, that's being a little bit wilder for God, isn't it? You're showing that your love for him is more than the conventions of this world. And when you choose to be wilder for God, it will bewilder a watching world. I pray that we can live this way, that we can see the example of David and live in such a way that people cannot understand the passion and the fire that we have for God that enables us to follow him no matter where he leads us. Will you pray with me? God, we thank you so much for this morning and for this time, and I pray now as we sing and celebrate who you are to us. God, we worship you and we thank you that if you are for us, and who can be against us? I pray that you give us that confidence, that you remind us where you have taken us and where you are going to take us, and that we would be willing to stand and to risk for you when you ask us to. I pray, God, that we would know the past, which would allow us to risk in the present because we believe the future you have for us. I pray that in my own life and over those of us who are here today, God, that we can live that out and be an example to a world that desperately longs to see people living for something greater than themselves. And we live for you and we love you, Jesus. And it's in your name that we lift it up.